for joining me. I'm Diane Rehm. The White House and congressional Republicans remain in a state of paralysis over terms raising the national debt ceiling. House Republican insistence on no compromise could mean just that as we head into the final days of avoiding potential U.S. default. Joining me to talk about what movement, if any, we're likely to see this week and why, E.J. Dionne of the Brookings Institution. He's also a columnist for The Washington Post. Janet Hook, she's congressional correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. And David Winston, Republican pollster and president of the Winston Group. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions and comments. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Janet Hook, if I could start with you. Few signs of movement over the weekend, but where are we now?
Well, I have to say, rarely has Washington seemed more leaderless and rudderless and kind of at sixes and sevens over what's going to happen next. And there's a lot of anxiety and suspense about raising the debt limit by August 2nd. And I think we're still in the stage where what's most obvious and before our eyes, angry partisan debates and bills not being passed and bills being passed, that's still a lot of political theater. And I think there is progress being made, or there's motion towards a compromise that is less obvious, that there's this week, right this week, the first half of the week will be taken up a lot with more partisanship, because both the House and the Senate are going to be approving bills that are straight Republican-conservative party-line documents, balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, and a bill that they call Cut, Cap, and Balance, which is the conservative program for balancing the budget over the long term and their condition for raising the debt ceiling. Cut spending, balance the budget, and cap spending over the long term. It's very drastic, and no Democrats are expected to vote for it. So it's kind of the Republican Party's way of saying, this is what we stand for, before they move ahead to any kind of compromise. And there are efforts underway in the Senate in particular to reach some kind of compromise that would involve allowing the debt ceiling to be raised, most by the president, and attaching with it some much smaller amount of spending cuts and a committee that would be tasked with coming up with some further longer-term deficit reductions. But that would be off in the future.
Janet Hook, she's congressional correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. EJ, this whole thing seems so unbelievable. You say it's an entirely artificial politician-created crisis.
Right. I think when this is over, we're going to look back and really challenge why conservative members of Congress, Republicans in this case, thought they could use the debt ceiling fight to have a showdown on the budget. The debt ceiling, the Post has this in its pages this morning. The debt ceiling was raised 17 times under Ronald Reagan. It was raised 7 times under George W. Bush. Many of the Republican leaders who are saying we won't raise the debt ceiling until we have all these cuts voted for those debt ceiling increases, many of them under President Bush.
So why
the
now?
Because they, I think, vastly overread the, quotes, mandate that they got out of the 2010 election. Secondly, they are very responsive to a very conservative element in their primary electorate, the Tea Party and the Tea Party's allies. So they want to make a big show of cutting spending. The country is really concerned with jobs and the economy. And I see this whole fight as a big distraction from where we should be. And this balanced budget amendment, which I hope we talk about later, I just think it's one of the most dishonest pieces of legislation we've seen before Congress. And I know that's saying a lot, because what it is a way to vote to slash Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, lock in tax increases. You know, I mean, low tax rates for the wealthy because they have supermajorities to require supermajorities for any tax increases. But your fingerprints on it. Fortunately, it won't pass. But it's really remarkable. It's replacing symbols with governing.
Jay Dionne, he's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, columnist for The Washington Post.
By the way, I want to correct that sentence. It's replacing governing for symbols.
Replacing governing for symbols. David Winston, how do you see it?
Well, not surprising. I'm going to have a slightly different take than EJ here. But first off, why the debt ceiling at this point in time, and why do you see conservatives and Republicans engaging? And I think there are a couple of elements into play. First off, we've never seen debts above, you know, federal deficits above $1 trillion a year. So that sort of creates some impetus, too. We've now had an anemic economy that clearly doesn't seem to be helping, at least in terms of generating the revenues that it needs to. And third, we've had historically high unemployment, 28, 29 months of 8% or higher. So it's an unusual situation. So given that, and also given the fact that these Republicans believe that every opportunity to take to sort of reduce the amount of spending that Washington is doing, they're going to take that opportunity. They've created this particular situation, saying, going back to the continuing resolution and now this as well, in terms of the debt ceiling, and you'll see it occur through the appropriations. This is the time. Having said that, also, it's not necessarily the first time. If I remember correctly, back in 2006, all the Democrats in the Senate also voted not to extend the debt ceiling. And so it's been a political football for a while. In this particular case, however, you're dealing with a majority who then you're dealing with a situation, I think you would see all four leaders agree in terms of the House and Senate, that ultimately we do want to increase the debt ceiling. The question is, how do we get there?
Just one quick point on the history. In the past, it was tacitly agreed that the debt ceiling would go up. When Republicans are in power, Democrats tended to vote against it, but the votes were there. And when it was the other way around, the party switched. But no one tried to use the debt ceiling in this particular way. That is genuinely new.
I would agree with that. And again, but I also would suggest that because the situation is so unique as well.
And what about Orrin Hatch's introduction of a balanced budget amendment this week in particular?
Well, clearly what Republicans are looking for is some sort of fiscal device, mechanism by which they can bring that sort of fiscal discipline that we would like to see put into place. There are those advocates of the balanced budget. There are those who are advocating economic growth policy. I think as Janet was describing, there are a lot of elements that are sort of moving at this point in terms of how do you coalesce that into what will eventually emerge. Having said that, Republicans clearly in the House tomorrow are going to vote on something that establishes at least where their position is as a starting point. And what you're also going to see from Republicans is a challenge to the president to say, okay, now give us your plan so we can, as we go through these last 2 weeks, begin to figure out how we get to a point that works.
David Winston, Republican pollster, president of the Winston Group. Janet Hook, this balanced budget amendment somehow seems to get things off track when, as EJ said, we're looking for new jobs, we're looking to get over this debt ceiling crisis. Why the introduction of the balanced budget amendment now?
Well, actually, I'd like to say one thing that's really interesting is the particular brand of balanced budget amendment that's been introduced by the Republicans is kind of designed to not pass. In the mid-90s, Congress came very close to passing a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, which was kind of what I called the plain vanilla balanced budget amendment. It just requires Congress to pass a balanced budget. This balanced budget amendment that the Republicans are pushing is much, much more stringent. It sets all kinds of conditions on how the budget is balanced and how the budget is written. It specifies not just that it be balanced, but that if there's any kind of tax increase involved, it has to be approved by a three-fifths or is it two-thirds, a supermajority, more than a simple majority. It specifies that federal spending can't exceed 18% of the gross domestic product, which
where
is much
right now
it's like 24-25%. So it's a bit much smaller share of the government. So what it is it's not just a balanced budget amendment. It specifies that it's a low tax, small government budget. Now, I actually think that if this was a plain vanilla balanced budget amendment, it would be really hard for Democrats to vote against it in these circumstances. As you say, it's a little bit of a sideshow from the central focus on what do we do right now about the debt limit or what do we do right now about jobs. I do think it speaks to a genuine frustration that Republicans and Democrats feel that every year we keep coming up against these problems. You know, what's the long-term solution? And there's this sense of Congress can't do it on its own. It needs some kind of external constraint. And that's what people think this constitutional amendment would do. I don't know whether, in fact, it would work out that way, but that is why I think people look to it at a time like this.
But you're saying it's designed to fail.
I think, like I said, I think that if they put up a simpler version, it would get more Democratic support, and there are little tiny signs that maybe they'd fiddle with it to get more support. But I think this is more intended to make a statement and to present a Republican conservative vision of government that goes beyond simply balancing budgets.
It's also a time waster, EJ.
Well, it's a time waster, but I think it's worse than a time waster because it's an attempt to use the Constitution of the United States to lock in a very particular set of highly ideological policies. The Ryan budget wouldn't qualify under this constitutional amendment. It makes the Ryan budget look like a social democratic document, given the cuts that would be required. I'd like to call attention to a column this morning by Ross Douthat, a conservative columnist. He's been a guest on this show before. And he made, I think, a very important point to his own conservatives, which is you can't enter a fight like this without having an endgame. And they weren't willing to compromise in the least. And I think from a conservative point of view, they could have gotten a deal that they rather liked, but they weren't prepared to compromise.
E.J. Dion, the Brookings Institution and The Washington Post. Short break. We'll be right back. I want to give you some early comments from listeners. Here's a tweet from Willis. This whole situation is unbelievable. I'm 20 years old. I believe the system is broken. I know many in my age group feel exactly the same. Another from Carrie in Cincinnati. The only thing this farce is related to is not, under any circumstances, cooperating with this president. He's been continually demonized in every way possible by Republicans, and they are happy to take the country down to new lows to do it. Politicians are hypocrites by nature, but this sets a new standard by far. How low can it go, David Winston?
Well, not surprising. I'm going to disagree with that conclusion. And I don't find some politicians are certainly hypocritical, but I would say generally they're trying to get to an outcome that is positive for the country. Having said that, you're in the middle of a debate here where you're seeing two viewpoints that two sides truly believe butting up against each other. And that is fundamentally Republicans believe, and this is where John Boehner is the speaker, And this is where I think the White House talks began to break down a bit. Boehner fundamentally believes that increasing taxes will contract the economy.
But why then did he seem to come to an agreement
because
with the president and then have to back away after Eric Cantor stepped in?
What he was willing to do was discuss how do you increase revenues through effective tax reform. And he was willing to have that conversation. What simply occurred was the president decided his concept of tax reform was increasing taxes, to which Speaker Boehner and the Republican caucus, that was just something that wasn't going to work. And as a result of that, that's what you saw the talks break down over.
Janet.
You know, what went on between President Obama and Speaker Boehner is a little bit of a mystery. I mean, it kind of, this was the quintessential backroom deal in
right.
the making.
Right.
And when things fell apart, we had to kind of put up with conflicting accounts of what happened and who was at fault. And to speak to the callers or the listeners' comment about hypocrisy among politicians, I actually do find, I don't know whether this is hypocrisy or just astonishing degrees of scripted political debate leading up to a very practical problem. I mean, I find at a certain point people have to kind of step back from their ideological arguments and start looking for a solution. And it's getting a little scary now that we're getting so close that people are not able to speak openly about possible compromises. And, you know, I guess we have to hold our breath while they go through another round of yelling at each other.
And putting my polling hat on for a second, I will tell you one of the problems the public has is when they hear both sides sort of discuss the sky is falling. Right now what they are hearing is political hyperbole, just as that individual is saying. They're not sure what to believe. And so it's hard to have a political discourse when people are listening to politicians assuming they're hearing hyperbole.
But this is not an equally balanced situation. The deal that Obama was talking about with Boehner, and Janet's right, we don't know all of the details of the deal, but the deal seemed to involve something like three times as much in spending cuts as tax increases. That is an awful lot of give from a Democratic president. He wanted that ratio. He wanted just a little bit of tax increase, mostly on the very wealthy who are doing just fine even in this economy, in order to give the Republicans real cuts in a lot of things. And I think if this deal had gone through, President Obama would have faced enormous opposition from within his own party. On the other side, you have Republicans who have made very clear that they don't really care about the deficit. What they care about is keeping taxes on the wealthy low, because they just weren't willing to give anything on that. And it's really odd to hear that Republicans, when the economy was good, said we needed to cut taxes on the wealthy because we shouldn't have too big a surplus. Now they're saying, well, the economy's bad and we can't do anything about taxes. If pulling money out of the economy is bad, then cutting the budget's bad, too. It's not a consistent argument.
What about the argument that you cannot raise taxes on the rich because they are the ones who create the jobs, Janet?
The argument is that there are a lot of small businesses that pay their taxes through the individual tax code. So if you raise taxes on the upper income brackets, it also affects small businesses. Now, it is true that small businesses are a significant and probably the major generator of jobs. I think that Republicans tend to overestimate how many of those small businesses pay their taxes this way. So it's a little bit of a fact-based debate that I can't quite mediate right now. I do think that what EJ's talking about, though, is I actually think that there are Republicans who were ready or seemed ready to make some concessions, small concessions, kind of like face-saving concessions on closing tax loopholes. There was this big debate about when is a tax increase not a tax increase,
right,
but a loophole closer. And even Eric Cantor, who seems to be the hardest line Republican on against raising taxes, was showing a little bit of willingness to say, yeah, fine, let's close some loopholes as long as we then take those revenues and cut taxes elsewhere. So I personally thought I saw a deal coming up where they'd kind of get rid of ethanol subsidies, close some tax loopholes on corporate jets and some of these things that the Democrats had focused a lot on, and then take that money and extend the payroll tax break that we're now about to see expire. And I don't know, in this endgame, that obvious kind of compromise seems to be fading. I don't know. Maybe it'll show up before it's all over.
It's striking that Republicans have shown so little interest in the payroll tax cut until up to this point. Somehow, maybe it's because it only goes primarily to the middle class. But the answer to your question, Diane, does raising taxes on the wealthy hurt the economy? Two-word answer, Bill Clinton. We raised taxes on the wealthy as a country in that budget deal, which hurt the Democrats so much in the 94 election. And guess what? We had the strongest economy we have had in years. I forgot over 20 million jobs created after the taxes went up. So this is an argument that's been disproven by history, and yet it comes around over and over again.
Okay. A variety of things. First off, I'd like to point out that in terms of a lot of job growth occurred after the Republicans sort of did the 97 tax cut, and there was a huge significant increase in terms of expansion.
But didn't we send the Clinton tax rates on the wealthy?
Well, they had a lot of tax cuts. It was almost $1 trillion, as a matter of fact. That's the first thing. Second, Tax Policy Center identified the amount of small businesses that taxes would go up on if, in fact, we got rid of those taxes for the wealthy. They said 894,000 small businesses.
A lot of them are doctors, lawyers who incorporate as small businesses.
DJ, here I'm going to have to disagree with you because I happen to be a chapter S. We happen to have people in our local community who have small businesses, gas stations, who are chapter S's, right? It is not just the hedge fund managers.
Okay, but let's hear from somebody in Greensboro, North Carolina, who says every time I hear Republicans shout out how we can't raise taxes on the rich because they're the ones who create the jobs we need, they've had over 10 years to do that, and the only jobs they created are outside the country while they've laid off our own workers. Okay. David.
Two elements. After the 2003 tax cuts that George Bush put into place, revenues in this country went up 44%, $800 billion by 2007. It's the largest expansion of revenues in the history of the country, and that was because of economic activity. And so when you're looking at what do you do, how do Republicans view taxes, they view the way to generate revenues, and this is where Boehner was going into these debates, through economic activity. You set tax rates to maximize economic activity. That occurred in terms of 64 when you had the Kennedy tax cuts, in 81 when you had the Reagan tax cuts, in 97 when you had the Clinton-Gingrich tax cuts, and in 2003 with the Bush tax cuts.
David happens to be one of my favorite Republican pollsters. I don't mean to ruin his business by saying that. But so I understand he's got to make these arguments. There were two big tax cuts for the wealthy under President Bush, and the net result was a loss in jobs between the beginning and the end of that period. So the notion that tax cuts are a magical elixir for the economy, it's just not true. We can have these debates over and over again, but it seems to me that the history of the last 20 years suggests that this is all a red herring. We should have tax revenues we need to support the amount of government that we seem to want as a country, and we just can't get there because there is this theology that tax cuts are always better than anything else.
Jenhead Hook of the Wall Street Journal, I know you've been following this very closely. How much control does Speaker Boehner have at this point?
Very good question. And I guess we'll find out when something comes for a vote. I mean, what we have right now is a situation where, I mean, you'll remember back in the spring when a somewhat easier vote came up before the House on a spending cut package that Boehner had negotiated. And Speaker Boehner lost the votes of 59 Republicans. And the going-in assumption is that at least that many will vote against the debt ceiling increase, no matter what's attached to it. I mean, I suppose if cut, cap, and balance was attached to it, they'd vote for it. So does he have control over those 60? I would say no. One thing that I found very interesting about the way all of the Republican leaders, including Senator McConnell and Eric Cantor, have been talking about this whole debate is they refer to proposals and they say, that can't pass, as if they, as leaders, are powerless over their rank and file. I mean, there's another approach to leadership, which is you take a bill that, you know, has stuff that your rank and file doesn't like and you try to sell it to them. Twisting arms is kind of the old-fashioned way they talked about it. I think actually that when they say that can't pass. It's just another way of saying I don't want it to pass. But there is this sense of disconnect, not disconnect, of the leadership not having control over the new rank and file. And it's not surprising. It's a completely different generation of Republicans who came to office actually promising not to follow their leaders.
That's, I mean, when you think back to the era of, say, LBJ, when, you know, if something had to be worked out, something got worked out. No longer, EJ.
Well, but we were operating within something like a consensus about government. Remember, LBJ was the Democratic leader when Dwight Eisenhower was president. Dwight Eisenhower was a very different kind of Republican than the Republicans who've come into office, especially since the 2010 election. And if I can take off my polemical hat and just put on an analytical hat and ask David, I think one of the fascinating things about this whole situation is that Speaker Boehner wanted to make a deal, which I think was a smart deal from the point of view of Republicans. He clearly did not read his caucus properly, or something else happened, and he couldn't make that deal with President Obama. Now he's facing a situation where no budget can get through without probably 40, 30, some very significant number of Democratic votes, which oddly takes the weakest player in this foursome of Senate and Senate Republicans, Senate Democrats, House Republicans, and House Democrats. It makes the House Democrats potentially quite powerful. So Boehner is stuck between a Tea Party rock and a Democratic hard place. He can't get all these Tea Party votes. He needs Democrats to get something done. So I'd like to know how David, as a brilliant consultant, solves this problem.
All right. Him. And before you answer that, David, let me just remind our listeners, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. David.
Well, what EJ defines is actually the classic problem any legislative leader has, and that is how do you balance your base that gives you the leadership position, and then how do you manage those people who, in fact, elected you to the majority, and how do you make those two work? Nancy Pelosi showed you how not to do that to a large degree in terms of going hard base. And Boehner is in the process of working through with 50% of his caucus being brand new, figuring out where they're going to go. Having said that, I will tell you that he has managed to, since he became minority leader, keep this conference together and moving together in the same direction. The challenge is, can he grow that and bring in Democrats as well to build a larger coalition? And you're facing some remarkable situations. And it's not a simple leadership dynamic when you've got unemployment at the scale, the economy the way it is, deficit the way it is. I think what you're seeing is Boehner recognizing how best to get to a conclusion and letting people do their jobs like he does with Eric Cantor and the rest.
All right. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Lakeland, Florida. Good morning, Joe. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, guys. Boy, you guys have been all over the place. but I want to my wife and I are both Republicans here in Florida, and we're done. We're very ashamed at the party for stymieing up the system. They seem to have a personal agenda against this president. That's the way we see it. She's a teacher. I'm a businessman. I see and talk to a lot of people daily. And everywhere from the street view, guys, the consensus is that there's something they have against this president. They don't want to let anything happen with this guy. They're trying to keep him a one-term president. We feel that the Republican Party is about not trying to allow the tax increases, because they are the rich. They are the supermajority. They are those people who will get those tax increases. The Republican Party, to us, we join because of the religious side of the party. But now the party seems to have uses that platform as their base, uses that base, and then, but yet does, I don't want to say sinful acts or sinful deeds, but uses our base to go out and do things pro-business, pro-money, pro-ant, but at the same time not keeping that Christian, to that standard. And it's just, it's not what we want to be a part of anymore. Also, it's Social Security, real quick. In 2001, 2003, Diane, maybe your staff could follow up on this and correct me on this, but I remember reading a byline where it said that Bush administration was raiding the Social Security fund to fund the war. So they went in and took that money out of that coffer to fund the war. I think it was for a year or for maybe 6 months. And then, I mean, that was millions of dollars that came out of the Social Security fund. And that money was never put back into that coffer. And then they went on and came to Congress for more money and more money. So does anyone remember that also, that happened?
All right. David Winston, do you remember that?
Well, actually, Social Security money has been used by government or by Congress to fund a whole bunch of things at this point. And that didn't occur. That's been going on for a long period of time.
When you say a long period of time, what do you mean?
Oh, geez, like I don't even know when it started. 70s, 80s. I mean, it's been a long time in terms of dipping and using Social Security money, and they've got significant amount of IOUs, the same bonds in terms of when we're dealing with the debt.
I thought Joe's point about his religious interest in the Republican Party and its operation was fascinating. We unfortunately have to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll comment on Joe's comments and more of yours. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
Lynchings and riots swept the nation during the summer of 1919. It became so bloody, it was dubbed Red Summer. How the violence changed race relations in the U.S. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back here in the studio, David Winston, Republican pollster, Janet Hook of the Wall Street Journal, E.J. Diana of the Brookings Institution and the Washington Post. We are trying to deal with the elements of Joe's heartfelt call from Lakeland, Florida. He identifies himself and his wife as Republicans who, because of religious beliefs, came to the party and now feel somewhat turned away from it. EJ.
This is a fight, maybe even a time bomb, that always exists inside the conservative coalition. It tends not to come up when liberals or Democrats are in power because the whole coalition can unite against liberal Democrats. But what it's about is the use of the votes of social and religious conservatives, mostly middle-class people, to support an agenda for the very affluent and for business. And I think that heartfelt call really speaks to the sense that a great many social conservatives have. Now, some social conservatives are Republican down the line, and they're loyal conservatives on these business and low taxes issues. But I think there are a lot of them who did not get into politics simply to fight for low taxes for the wealthy. And I think this gentleman reflects that feeling that I think is out there within a very significant part of that constituency.
Now, here's an email from Rennie, and I'd like to know if there's any polling on this. Rennie says, "We are all so ashamed of our government. They're busy doing silly, unnecessary things instead of making the deals we need. We have to raise revenue. Any adult knows this perfectly well. We've had our fun, indulged ourselves in wars of limited utility. Now we have to pay." David Winston.
Well, and this gets back to, look, there's a fundamental difference of opinion between the President of the United States and Speaker Boehner in terms of the role of taxes and how do you increase revenues, right? This president believes, and by the way, Christine Romer disagrees with him in the sense of when you increase taxes, you'll be able to generate the revenues. She's saying that, in fact, will contract the economy. That's what John Boehner believes. It's going to contract the economy, and therefore you won't get the revenues that you need unless you set tax rates at the right level to maximize economic
activity.
So my point is it's not for the wealthy. It's how do you get the country going? And again, I'm going to go back to my point. When Bush cut taxes in 2003, over that next four-year period, you had an $800 billion increase in revenues, the largest increase in the history of the country. And someone's got to explain to me and to the Speaker as to why that didn't occur because of those tax cuts.
Janet.
I thought the word that really stuck with me in the comment you just read was ashamed, that people are looking at the government and feeling ashamed. The way the debate has been conducted is as disturbing as I have this ridiculous faith that it's all going to work out fine in the end, that they're not going to let the country go into default. But I don't think that people are coming away from the public side of the debate thinking that really statesmanlike things are going on here. I do think that, I don't know. There's all kinds of polling that shows that people's confidence in Congress is rock bottom levels. I don't read too much into those polls just because often confidence in government reflects sort of the general state of the economy. But right now, I hear it from friends and family as well as reading it in polls that people really don't think that this is an episode that says much about how well our government works.
The answer to David's question is we had a little spurt of growth after the economic downturn, but the rate of growth was lower than the rate of growth was during the Clinton years. So those tax cuts did not do it. And again, the long trajectory of the Bush administration suggests those didn't work. Second, nobody is talking about raising taxes until 2013. It's actually President Obama who's talking about cutting taxes next year with the payroll tax cut. So nobody's talking about pulling this money out of the economy. And I am honestly very worried on the other side that if we cut too deeply now, we will be pulling money out of the economy. This is all about the long term. And the last thing is that caller's absolutely, or that emailer is absolutely right. The government needs more revenue. The debate we should be having between progressives and conservatives is how do you raise that money? Bruce Bartlett, former official of the Reagan administration, says we shouldn't do it with taxes on the rich. We should do it with a value-added tax. I would say, no, we should do it primarily with higher taxes on the wealthy. But that's a reasonable argument to be had between progressives and conservatives. But to have conservatives say we can go on and on like this without ever raising revenue again is just irresponsible.
All right. To Cleveland, Ohio, to Neil. Good morning.
I have a couple of points. One, just in response to that last comment by your guest about what Christina Romer believes. I'm looking at her recent article in the New York Times, and what she says there does not match what your guest said. She specifically says that increased taxes are not as harmful to the economy as he's claiming. This is from July 2nd. My other point is I think the Republicans are being completely disingenuous. When they were in power, they all applauded when Dick Cheney said deficits don't matter. They all voted, those of them that were in power at the time, to keep two wars off the books, vastly increasing our debt. They voted for a Medicare drug plan that was not going to be paid for. And I think they have somewhat deliberately tried to evade responsibility for the economy they created, which unfortunately Mr. Obama inherited. And I think it's an exercise in astonishing dishonesty.
David Winston.
To go to the Christina Romer point, this is an article in today's New York Times, and I'll just read it. It says, Republicans also cite paper published by Christina Romer, a former chairwoman of Obama's economic advisors, and her husband David Romer, which studied tax hikes in the United States since World War II. The couple, professors at Berkeley, reported that a 1% tax increase reduced economic activity on average by 3% over 3 years.
I wonder if the caller is citing a later article written by Christine Romer.
I'm citing an article from July 2nd in which she says specifically that some in Washington and the news media have seized on a study that she conducted with her husband, and it shows that tax increases have a bigger short-term effect on the economy than spending cuts. They are mistaken. July 2nd, New York Times. This is by Christina Romer herself.
Well, I'm just quoting what the New York Times said today in terms of what she
said.
Well,
so they're not.
This is her reply to that.
Well, I mean, she said she wrote what she wrote. I mean, you can try to explain
it later. She wrote what she wrote, but apparently some people interpreted it in a way that she did not intend, is what she's saying.
Well, I mean, that's what the New York Times says that she said, so I'll just leave it at that. By the way, I want to go back to one point. Actually, EJ, during the period right after the 2003 tax cuts, economic growth was on par, if not slightly larger than what Clinton had.
Mr. Winston, an economist? Because I don't really...
Yes, I did. I did econometrics, statistical policy analysis and econometrics at the Heritage Foundation.
Oh, well, that means nothing to me. I don't regard the Heritage Foundation as the equivalent of an academic.
Okay. All right. Thanks for your call, Neil. And let's go now to Sycamore, Illinois. Good morning, Hamish.
Yes, good morning. Unfortunately, we are no longer a government of the people and for the people. We are a government of the politicians for the lobbyists, which in turn go to big business. There isn't one problem that we have in Washington, D.C. that doesn't have an answer. It's just we have nobody there that wants to cooperate with anybody else. The government wasn't made for the Republicans or for the Democrats. It was made for us, the people.
Okay.
Well, you know, I think part of the problem is that what we're seeing right now shows that when one side of the debate, which is the right end of the Republican Party, just does not want to operate within what has broadly been a consensus in our history, a consensus that says we value individual initiative and we also know the government needs a strong role in the economy to make things work. This is a view that goes back to Henry Clay, Alexander Hamilton, Abraham Lincoln. We now have one piece of our debate, one part of our debate, that regards government, in the words of Mr. Kane, the Republican candidate, as the caboose, as if you can just disempower government and everything will be fine. And when we get back to a time where we have a more reasonable debate about, well, should government do this or not? Should it do that or not? And should we pay for it? And how do we pay for it? We're going to have this chaos. And
all right.
I'm afraid that this really is the creation of a very far-right view that really is outside the American mainstream.
To Roland. He's in San Antonio, Texas. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I'd like to remind everybody, these Tea Party elected officials, they were voted by the people in their particular districts, okay? You can talk all you want about that, they want to bring the country down. They were still elected by the people. And they did not come into elected office that were duly elected. That's why they have a lot of influence with the Republican Party.
All right, Janet Hook.
Yeah, I actually think that Roland's comment is an answer to the previous caller in Illinois who thought that people don't matter anymore. I mean, the midterm elections show that elections do still matter, and it was a very strong political movement that changed Congress a lot.
What about the gerrymandering that took place before those 2010 elections that placed individuals within certain areas depending on whether they were liberal or whether they were Tea Party or whether they were conservative Republicans? Is that true?
Well, there's actually the gerrymandering or the redistricting of congressional districts is going on right now based on the 2010 census. Every 10 years, they redraw the lines. And for the last couple of decades, when they've redrawn congressional lines, yes, there has been a real homogenization. They take districts and they draw them in a way that they're mostly Republican or mostly Democrat, and it tends to favor incumbents. However, I don't think that that explains the phenomenon of the Tea Party and what happened in the 2010 elections per se. I mean, this was the end of a period. Right now, they're redrawing the lines. I do think that that has contributed over the last 20, 30 years to the real polarization of politics in the House, that the Republicans who are there are really conservative and the Democrats are really liberal and the center is getting smaller and smaller.
The gentleman makes a fair point, and Janet's absolutely right. Elections matter. I think two things have happened. One is progressives were asleep in 2010, and conservatives were very mobilized, and they had a real impact, particularly in the House races, but to a lesser degree in the Senate. But secondly, I think what you're seeing is a lot of moderate Republicans have left the Republican Party and don't vote in primaries anymore, so that Republicans are putting up a much, much more conservative group of candidates. And when you have an election like 2010, when the country was very unhappy, it's a big protest election, the people elected are extremely conservative. And sort of example number one was Christine O'Donnell defeating Mike Castle in Delaware, Mike Castle being a very respected moderate Republican, someone whom I think most Republicans agreed was not fully prepared to be a U.S. Senate candidate, one, because it was an ideological electorate.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What about the candidates for presidential nomination on the Republican side? What are they saying about all this, David?
Well, I think right now the challenge to them, and one of the reasons why you may see a generic person leading the president, but you don't actually see an individual Republican candidate leading the president, is to some degree they're still talking about personality. And ultimately, the challenge to the Republican candidates is, what is the big idea that's going to get one of them elected? You know, I go back and to sort of go back to the beginning where E.J. said this issue, the issue facing the country's economy and jobs. He's absolutely correct. And look, one of the challenges to this new majority is there are things that they want to do, but there are also things that have to occur for the country. And so when we're looking at this whole discussion about what's happening with the debt ceiling, most Americans are looking at it from the point of view is, what is this going to do to the economy? What is this going to do to job creation? And ultimately, that's how they're going to judge the success or failure of whatever anybody does here. And that's where the country's
at. But that's why they've got to do something.
I think EJ would agree. My sense is we are going to get to some sort of resolution. Everybody understands the seriousness of it. But you also have some pretty significant differences that people truly believe. And you're going to have to work through that. And that just takes some time.
Just by the way, generic candidates always do better than real candidates, because all of God's children, actual human beings, have flaws. And generic candidates are perfect because they don't exist. Just secondly, I think we will get a solution. And what's fascinating here in the dynamic is that you really have Republicans in the U.S. Senate in a very different place than Republicans in the House of Representatives. I think part of that is that Mitch McConnell looks at the array of seats that are up in 2012, sees a real opportunity for Republicans to take the majority. He really doesn't want to upset the apple cart. He wants the Republicans to take over the Senate. He would like to arrange some sort of compromise that keeps him with an issue but doesn't force him to either have the country default on its debt or do something radical. And I think what you're going to see is a dynamic where the Senate is going to pull the House along to a deal that a lot of conservatives in the House won't like. I'm curious if Janet sort of has that view or has a different perspective.
No, I think that's right. I think Mitch McConnell kind of stepped forward last week with this proposal on the debt ceiling that everybody was left scratching their head saying, what he's proposing to let the president raise the debt ceiling unilaterally and not tie it to spending cuts? It just sounded totally contrary to where the Republicans were going.
But wouldn't that mean you'd have the same argument year after year, decade after decade?
I think that part of the proposal itself, that's not setting it up for the continuing debate. The other part of the proposal that does do that is they're proposing to set up a special committee to make recommendations on how to reduce the deficit by the end of the year. Well, hello. I mean, entitlements, taxes, it's the same thing.
Same thing.
Recapitulating.
And hadn't we already heard from the Simpson Bowles?
Right. The one difference on this one is I think what McConnell and Senator Reid are proposing would have a mandatory House and Senate vote on it. Part of the problem with Simpson-Bowles is there was no mandatory action requirement, and so Congress did what it often does, is
right.
Ignored it.
Also,
what?
To have actual politicians who might actually have to vote on something making these choices gives it, I think, a little better chance than an outside group with only partly politicians.
One-word answer from each of you. Will we meet the deadline?
Yes.
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 Last words from David Winston, Republican pollster Janet Hook, The Wall Street Journal, E.J. Dionne, the Brookings Institution, and The Washington Post. Thank you all so much.
Thank you,
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Katie June Friesen answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales.